Sir?
Good afternoon, ICANN 61, March 12th, How It Works, Understanding DNS Abuse.
It works.
Good afternoon, everyone. We will be starting shortly the How It Works, Understanding DNS Abuse, in a couple of minutes. Thank you.
Adios.
Good afternoon again, everyone. Welcome to our How It Works session on Understanding DNS Abuse. We have Carlos Alvarez from the Office of the CTO presenting for this session. Carlos?
Thank you so much, Kathy. Thank you, all of you who are here in the room. And also, I have a good number of participants online. I understand there are about 23, maybe more, as we advance through the session. We're going to talk about a topic that's very important. It's very relevant. It's also contentious in some respects, and something that people need to pay attention to. We're going to be talking about DNS abuse. So first, we're going to lay out some of the sides of the discussion. There are different sides. People understand DNS abuse from different perspectives. We're going to lay out some of those perspectives here. Then we're going to go over some examples of DNS abuse or misuse. We're going to talk about little bit about the evolving threat landscape as it has to do with DNS. And then we'll end up with a little bit of DNS abuse within the ICANN context. So the first thing that's worthy of mention is that there is no globally unified accepted definition of what DNS abuse means. As the slide that you're saying says, there are definitional variants that include broad topics such as cybercrime, hacking, and malicious conduct. And you can consider that DNS abuse falls under three categories. It could be data corruption, denial of service, and privacy. And there's, of course, the differentiation between DNS misuse versus DNS abuse. And reading a bit what this slide is telling you, misuse refers to intentionally deceptive, conniving, or unsolicited activities that actively make use of the DNS or the procedures used to raise their domain names or resolve them. We're going to see what this means. We'll see that later on. So what has the GAC said trying to reach a definition or provide elements to understand what DNS abuse is? What has the GAC said with regards to this broad area? The GAC provided in its communique the safeguards that were applicable to all the new utilities in an excerpt of the document that was related to mitigating abusive activity. It mentioned certain abusive activities such as distribution of malware, operation of botnets, phishing, piracy, trademark and copyright infringement, fraudulent or deceptive practices, counterfeiting, and other types of activities that may be contrary to applicable law. That seems broad, and some are of the view that there are some topics included there that may not necessarily be technical abuse of the DNS as a technical protocol or as a technical system. But, as I said, we're presenting some of the views that the community has. This is one of those views. And there's the other side that considers specifically trademark and copyright infringement, and in certain cases fraudulent or deceptive practices, not to be considered as technical DNS as such for many reasons. There's a big question. I will leave it as an open-ended question during this session with regards to whether or not spam is or should be considered abuse of the DNS, of the domain name system. While on the side of the operational security community and law enforcement, spam is seen and is considered an indicator and a predecessor of other types of malicious activity. In and of itself, at least until today, it has not been considered technical abuse as such of the DNS, of the global domain name system. So when you're doing threat research and you're analyzing data, you see that there's a spam campaign that was just launched. You detect the infrastructure, you identify the criminal infrastructure that the bad actors are using for that campaign. And if you continue to follow their activity, you will sooner or later, usually sooner rather than later, you will see the follow-up activity that's exactly following up after the spam was sent. It can either be malware distribution, it can be distribution of child abuse material, it can be phishing, different types of things. In simpler terms, DNS abuse refers to anything that attacks or abuses the DNS infrastructure, and we'll see that in a few slides ahead. There's many ways to see DNS abuse. We're going to talk about two ways to slice this topic. One is the perspective of the abuse of the resolution of the domain names, the technical portion of how domain names are translated into IP addresses. And the other perspective that we're going to talk about is the registration of the domain names, the provision of registration services. Those services that are provided by registries and registrars are abused by the criminals in different ways, so we're going to talk about that as well. Then DNS misuse refers to exploiting the DNS protocol at a more technical level or the registration processes for malicious purposes. All these we're going to exemplify and explain in more detail as long as this works. I'm aiming? Yes, there. Sorry, you don't need to read all these slides. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to show you the operational elements of the DNS at a simplified scale. You have on top, in the blue font word, the authoritative name servers that host the data that's authoritative for each domain name or for each TLD, for that matter. Then right below, you have the recursive name resolvers, which you could see as the DNS servers that your ISP, the company that provides you with the internet access, lets you use. They provide you with the DNS resolution service. And then you have the client or the stop resolvers. What's a stop resolver? It's right here. It's a function within my browser, for example, that looks for the information that it needs to be able to use the resources that I want to use. For example, if I go to the browser and type ws.icann.org, the stop resolver function will be called in, and it will resolve the domain name into the IP address where the content for ws.icann.org will be hosted, and it will download it to my device, and I will be able to see it and interact with it, etc. These three operational elements of the DNS are targets for attacks, and we'll see it. Basically, everything that's online is a target for attack. Examples, and this is where it gets interesting. Let's focus on reflection and amplification, which are at the heart of the DDoS attacks, the distributed denial of service attacks. What's reflection? Reflection means that you can send a packet, falsify the information about the source IP address so that the server believes that it was sent by someone else, which will have that server send the response to that other IP address. So if my purpose is to attack Kathy, I will send the packet to the DNS server, and the IP address that I will forge into that packet will say that the packet itself is coming from Kathy, not from me. If I do that using what are called open resolvers, which are DNS servers that exist out there, are thousands of them, that don't filter the IP addresses where the queries are coming from and respond to queries from any user in any region of the world, then Kathy is going to be flooded, because I will send DNS queries to those thousands of open resolvers that are out in the wild, and all of them will think that all those queries were sent by Kathy, so they will all respond to her. That's reflection. And the other vector is amplification. And what does amplification mean? It means that each of those queries that I'm sending is tiny. It can be, and it usually is only a line of command. And that line can be as simple as dig, name server, domain name, any. Boom, that's it. That's 7 bytes, maybe. It's really tiny. It's just a line of text. While as the response will be huge, it can be 2.3, 2.5, 2.7 megabytes. Multiply that by the thousands of queries that I am having my botnet send. Remember the botnets, those large networks of compromised devices that the criminals operate. They can have hundreds of thousands of compromised devices. And the criminal operating the botnet can have all those compromised devices send queries to all those open resolvers that are out there, sending Kathy those responses. So it's a multiplication effect, because of the number of compromised devices that I have recruited and are part of my botnet, then the amount, the thousands of open resolvers that I am leveraging, and the way that I send the command, the dig query. Dig is a command that allows you to obtain information from the DNS. It triggers a response, and the way they craft that command is such that the response is huge, as I just mentioned. So Kathy will very likely be knocked offline if she's not on some sort of DDoS protection service or what have you. But if she can't withstand the traffic that's going to come to her, she's going to go offline. There's no way to prevent it. The first large DDoS attack that, if I'm not wrong, was seen using the DNS as a vector of attack was in 2003 against Spam House. Spam House is an organization that focuses on not only spam, but malware, etc. They do investigations. They provide interesting data for mitigation and protection against threats, etc. And, of course, the attacks keep on evolving. Now, of course, the DNS is not the only attack vector by any means. It's one of them. But as a protocol, it is exploited, and it's often exploited. We'll also talk about cache poisoning or exhaustion attacks. That's mentioned second to last. And the last DNS man-in-the-middle attack, we'll also talk about those a few slides ahead. There. This is basically what I just described. This is a large DDoS attack that's making use of reflection, sending packets that are forging their source IP address, making all those open resolvers think that it's Kathy, the device that's sending the queries. Then the query that they receive is such that it triggers a large response. That's the amplification vector, and Kathy gets flooded. It's exactly what I just described. That wasn't me. Talk about going ahead of myself. I had too much coffee. Where were we? Here. Another way in which you can attack the DNS is by going against someone's name servers. The name server is part of the infrastructure that's used to provide resolution for a domain name. So if I register carlos.whatever, I will have to set, ideally at least, two servers that the DNS as a global system to obtain information about the resources that I have associated with that name. In other words, I will define and will make that information available through those name servers, the IP addresses, just to put it very simply, where my mail server will be located, where my web server will be located, where my FTP server will be located, etc. So if anyone knocks offline my name servers, no one will be able to access that information, which means that I will not receive email nor send. People will not be able to access my website, etc. So it can have consequences if it's a high-value domain name. Not that carlos.whatever is not a high-value target. It probably is. It doesn't exist, but it would be. The way it works, this type of attack, is that criminals use abuse the TCP protocol. When you send a TCP packet to a server, the server responds, and this is again put very simply, and when the server responds to the TCP connection, both the device that started the connection and the server that's responding, they establish a handshake, which creates a channel of communication that's maintained by both. That means that both have to allocate certain resources to maintain that channel of communication. So if you have a lot of compromised devices in a botnet, and you have them all send responses, queries to a name server in a way that it'll force that server to establish too many TCP handshakes so that it has to allocate resources to maintain those established channels of communications via TCP, you will soon reach a point in which that server will no longer have resources available to allocate any more TCP connections, which will mean that no one else will be able to ask that server for DNS information. It'll still be online, but it will not be able to answer any query. As the slide says, name resolution is degraded or interrupted. If you're lucky, you'll be able to get a response a couple minutes afterwards. Multiply that thousands of times if it's a high traffic domain name, or you may lose resolution at all. And that's the worst case scenario that everyone wants to avoid. Poisoning a cache. This is trickery. This is the bad guys being creative, as they always are. Well, sometimes they're really dumb. Remember that we mentioned in a previous slide that on top we had the authoritative name servers? Like if I created and registered carlos.whatever and I associated ns1.carlos.whatever and ns2.carlos.whatever to provide the DNS with the information associated with my mail servers, my web server, etc. Those are my authoritative name servers. But then every ISP and many people out there, 9.9.9.9 or 8.8.8.8 or OpenDNS, UltraDNS, there are many DNS providers. Those are recursive, which means that they ask questions on behalf of someone else. And there are some of those recursive resolvers, as they are known, that are not well protected. They are vulnerable. Imagine all the thousands of internet service providers that are out there in all the regions. Some are operated by small companies with not too many resources, so they have the infrastructure to operate, but they may not have the resources to protect it. And when those servers are not protected enough, then criminals may compromise them in many different ways, one of which can mean that if I am a user of an ISP that has a compromised recursive resolver, and I send a query looking for data associated with what have you, PayPal.com, I may get the response, the correct response, but then since the server is compromised, the criminals will add an extra bit of information there. And that extra bit of information there will be something like, oh, and by the way, the IP address for bankofamerica.com is this. And it'll automatically update my device's temporary memory, its cache memory. In my device, it'll be the host's file. And when that happens, guess where my device will take me the next time that I want to visit bankofamerica.com. If it happens within a defined time period, it'll take me to the IP address that the criminals wanted me to go visit. So that's a bad scenario. That's not nice. What will happen then? I will visit the criminals' operated server. I will see the content that they want me to see, which in this case would be a phishing site mimicking Bank of America. And then I would gladly provide them with my username and password, which, well, will not be good for my personal finances, of course. There are other ways in which criminals can do things like this. They can compromise your device directly and modify your DNS configuration. When they do that, and we'll see an example later on of a bad botnet that was taken down a couple years, like 4 years ago, I think, is that if my device is configured to send DNS queries to, let's say, just an example, 1.1.1.1, they change that IP address here or in the laptop, and instead of that legit user intended IP address, they put their own. They put there an IP address of a DNS server that they operate that's configured to provide IP addresses to their own infrastructure. In other words, they will have all the users whose devices are compromised, they will have all those users visit their own websites, which again is not nice. We'll talk about this in a little bit. In a case like this, and talking about specifically about poisoning a cache, the way they do it is that they have the user compromised device send the queries to their DNS server. Say that I'm asking for a site that's not relevant to the criminals. Whatever, a news site, although everything is relevant to them, or anything can be relevant to them, but let's say that news.whatever is not a relevant site to the criminals. Just as they did in the previous example that I gave, they add an extra bit of information to that response that their server is sending my device. And that extra bit of information could be, similarly, the IP address. Oh, and by the way, the IP address for your bank's website is this. So again, within a defined time period, I query for the domain name, for my bank's domain name, because I want to go and do some online banking, and boom, I end up at the criminal's website. And again, bad for my personal finances. DNS changer is exactly the malware type that I was mentioning. A DNS changer, that's exactly what it did. It changed the user intended DNS configuration. And it was pretty pervasive. The criminals that led this botnet, the masterminds behind this operation, were able to make a lot of money. By the time the law enforcement operation took place, law enforcement was able to prove with hard evidence that they had obtained illegally 25 million euros. That doesn't mean that they didn't make more. It just means that's what law enforcement was able to prove with actual evidence. With DNS changer, the criminals changed the DNS configuration on the user devices. And they did something that seemed to be pretty innocuous, in that they were replacing the advertisements that users would see when they went to websites. So if I went to my preferred news website in the morning at the office with my cup of joe, then instead of the legitimate advertisements that I would see, they had replaced those with their own. And it just generated income for them on an ongoing basis. And that happened for a very long time. So that's a money machine. And it doesn't harm, so it seems. So users didn't see any weird behavior in their devices. They were still able to access the content that they wanted to. They were still able to interact with the internet and the resources that they needed to. So apparently nothing weird was going on. Well, there was. Yeah. So the action took place, and there was a concern because there were so many infected devices. I don't remember the exact amount of devices, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of devices that were compromised within this botnet by this malware type in a number of countries. I don't want to lie. It might have been around 20 countries, but I'm not super sure. So the question came when they were going to have to, law enforcement, they were going to have to do something with those DNS servers that the criminals were operating. Either they could turn them off, in which case, what do you guys think would have happened if they would have turned those DNS servers off? If all the user devices were sending DNS queries to those servers, what would have happened? Users would have thought that they had lost the internet connection. They would still be connected to the internet, but their devices wouldn't resolve any name because the DNS servers were off. So they couldn't just turn them off. What they did was that using engineering, to put it in a way, they were able to replace those servers and the court assigned an administrator for those servers during a period of time, while through the national certs and different techniques, awareness campaigns were conducted in all those jurisdictions so that users realized they had to clean up their devices. Of course, since the criminals are criminals, they have found many different ways of abusing the DNS as a protocol and the different operational elements of the DNS, some of which are interesting, at least from an academic perspective, because it shows creativity for bad purposes, but it's creative. Like covert exfiltration channel, I think this is covered in the next slide. Now, let's talk about it. A covert exfiltration channel occurs when you are able to send data from a compromised network without the administrator of the network realizing that they are having their data stolen. That's the covert part. And the DNS is considered to be an interesting covert exfiltration channel because usually that little port that's used for DNS communications is not blocked. It cannot be blocked. So traffic in networks travels via ports from one port to another. The port that's used by the DNS protocol is port 53. And while there are ways in which engineers can reassign that port internally within their own network, it can have some complications. So usually it's never reassigned or moved to a different port. So that means that traffic through port 53 cannot be blocked. It's very complicated to reassign it, or so it simply cannot be blocked. If it's blocked, then people will not have DNS resolution, which means that they will think that they are offline. How does it work when you have a covert exfiltration channel? Different ways, at least two that I can think of right now. One way, you compromise the device and have that device start sending DNS queries slowly out to a name server, a criminal name server. The thing is that within each DNS query, the criminals have replaced the least relevant bits with the bits that correspond to the data that they are exfiltrating. So the DNS queries are still DNS queries. If the engineering team or the administrator of the network is looking at those queries, is looking at the traffic, they will still only see that it's DNS queries. They would have to gather all the DNS queries that are being used for the exfiltration of the specific piece of data, gather them. It takes analysis, basically. Realize that the least relevant bits were modified, put together those least relevant bits, and try to make something of them. And then realize what it was that was being exfiltrated. That's one way. Then another way in which criminals, which is a little easier, in which criminals use the DNS to exfiltrate information is through the text records. When you create a domain name, you have to administer, you by default will administer or manage what's called a zone file. In the zone file of your domain name, you define the resources that are associated with it. That's where you include the information for your website, your mail server, your FTP server. If you have your domain DNSSEC signed, that information is going to go there. If you have other techniques that are for the protection of your customers or the general public, I don't know, maybe some of you may have heard of those. It's more acronyms, unfortunately, SPF, DKIM, and DMARC, which basically simply protect the users, just to put it simply. All those kinds of information go in what is known as text records. And you can actually put anything in a text record. There's no limitation the kind of text that can go in a text record. It's just text. So criminals use those text records to exfiltrate information as well. They can send dig queries with information regarding text records out to a name server that then gathers the information, groups them, recreates the data that was exfiltrated, and so on. And then fast logs. I think this is mentioned down the road, I think. If not, we'll come back to it, but I think it is mentioned. Domain name registrations are sweet targets for attackers. That's pretty obvious. Criminals and malicious actors unfortunately abuse legitimate providers of domain registration services on both the gTLD and the ccTLD spaces. They love to abuse registrars and resellers. They love to obtain large amounts of domain names. It's a very complicated problem to address. Lower prices of domain names tend to lure bad actors, which is just human nature, I think. The cheaper is better, so they just go in and raise more domain names. Just as legitimate registrants and users are lured into registering more domain names when they are cheaper, which, again, as I said, is just human nature. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just how it works. And then the automated registration of the domain names creates, which again is not neither good or bad. It's just how the industry evolved, and it allows for the operation of large portfolios of legitimate domain names, of course. But then the criminals had to be there abusing it, unfortunately. And when I mention this, I'm thinking of the DGA domains, which is basically automation in the criminals' hands for the creation and registration of large amounts of domain names. What's a DGA? It's a domain generation algorithm. That's a, imagine a botnet. Every botnet has to have a command and control infrastructure that's used by the criminals for them to be able to continue to precisely command and control their malicious infrastructure. But what happens if that infrastructure is taken down? They need to have a plan B, C, D, E, F, G, and so on. That's what the DGAs are there for. When the botnet realizes that one of those servers associated with command and control is down, it was suspended, or it was knocked offline, or whatever, then it raises, and it's just an example. There are all the colors and flavors and variations of DGA behavior. This is just a simplified explanation. the poop raises any string under whatever tilde, and off it goes. If the command control capabilities of the botnet had degraded because of threat mitigation action, then with the registration of that new DJ string, boop, they regain the lost command control capability and just continue their operation. We're going to mention a very interesting case. I hope we're near that slide. Well, why do attackers and criminals raise their domain names for everything? Anything that you guys can think of, for phishing, ransomware, malware distribution, scams, counterfeit goods, illegal pharmaceutical, I mean, you mention it. And then the last line, that I don't know why it's showing like that. It's command and control, which is, with regards to stability and resiliency, that's the biggest concern because of the size of the attacks. And there are questions sometimes about illegal pharmaceutical, whether or not that should be considered DNS abuse when it's apparently not related to DNS abuse, technically at least. And it's similar more to the counterfeit selling websites, etc. And that's true, but there are sometimes things underneath what's just on the surface. I can't go into details, but there, just keep in mind there are things that are underneath what you see in the surface. You may see that it's simply a bunch of websites that are used to send illegally in certain jurisdictions medicines, but what's underneath it is something bad. That harms a lot of people. Do you have a question? Would you please come to a microphone?
Please feel free to use any of the microphones on the tables, and please give us your name and affiliation if you have any. Thank you.
My name is Farzana Bayi. I am the non-commercial stakeholder group chair. The question is in my personal capacity. When you say that under the domain name that sells illegal drugs, there might be like some other bad stuff. Do you mean there might be some technical abuse, or are we talking about the content of the website?
I'm talking about criminal operations that make use of domain names. So it's use of the domain names in relation to the content of the websites and more criminal activity that follows after that.
Just a follow-up, Farzana speaking. So this has nothing to do with DNS and its technical operation?
It's the use of the domain name for that purpose.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So why pay if you can crack? Why would criminals pay for domain names, or why do some choose to pay for domain names when they can crack and just gain control of them? There are different situations in which criminals will choose to, instead of registering, going for the kill and hijack domain names. How do they do this? They can compromise the user credentials, they can compromise their registrant access credentials to the control panel. The control panel is their web interface that allows registrants to manage their domain name. So imagine a criminal organization that wants to take over a specific high-value domain name, or they want to harm clients of a specific bank. They may just send a spear phishing campaign, a targeted phishing campaign directed at the employees of that bank after some social engineering, as usual, lure those workers of that bank into clicking a link that they shouldn't have clicked, and then just steal the access credentials, and whatever happens afterwards goes as far as the criminal wants to. They can simply create a third-level domain underneath it, the second-level domain that you see. If my bank had suffered a situation like this, say my bank is Carlos' bank, dot whatever, the criminal could create alfishu.carlos.bank.whatever and then send the email out as part of a phishing campaign, luring victims more successfully because they will see that the second level domain is actually my bank's real domain name. Or they may change the name servers completely. They may change any information that's associated with the domain name. They can change any record. They can take down the entire set of information that's within the zone file for the name. Then again, there's situations where it has happened, unfortunately, that registrars that may not have their infrastructure properly secured have been compromised. It doesn't happen often at all, which is good, but it's happened. And when that happens, it's not a good situation. Fortunately, in those very few cases that we've seen, the criminals went after very specific high-value targets. And the registrars were very quick to respond. That was some time ago, actually. And that was handled very properly. But the criminals were after targets that they knew in advance they would be able to gain if they got control of those servers. So you see it on the user side. If the registrants are lured into clicking a link and then the usual fish that gets successful, or on the attack on the registration infrastructure if it gets to be successful. What I was mentioning, well, this is another side of phishing. How many registrants would have their same access credentials to the control panel through which they manage their domain names? How many registrants would have the same access credentials in that control panel as they did in an account that they got compromised before? In any of the tens of compromises and large breaches that are seen every week, basically, or every month, that's an unknown. And with the credential stuffing is criminals attempting to log into as many services as they can with the pairs of username, password that have been compromised in prior breaches, data breaches. When they get in and you're dead. And that's a big unknown. There's no way to test that. That's a big unknown. How many registrants are using their passwords for the management of their domain registrations? That's awareness as usual. Fastlux, it's here. Fastlux is a technique that criminals use that allow them to hop from IP address to IP address very rapidly with the purpose of making the work of law enforcement and threat mitigation professionals more and more complicated. The way they do this is that they define in their zone files short TTLs. The TTL is the time to leave. That's the time during which the IP address that, for example, may be associated with the website will be valid. After that time, the recursive resolvers out in the wild will know that they have to query again to obtain that information again. And when they do, they will receive a different IP address. So when you see short TTLs like 120 seconds, 180 seconds, 2, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, then that's something that threat researchers look with a, you see, it's... The caveat here is that the large CDNs, the CDNs are the content delivery networks, for their own operation to provide stability and provide load balancing and other technical reasons, they also use short TTLs, but that's different. So if you're a threat researcher, you know which are the large networks that use TTLs, and that's fine. But if you come across a new domain that has a short TTL that's associated on top of it with some newly seen infrastructure that may have been seen in association with spam or something, then that raises a brow immediately. Boop. And that's when threat researchers are tempted into blocking traffic associated with that infrastructure. For the protection, that was my... Now, double fast clocks, and what happens when you're law enforcement and you're investigating a criminal infrastructure or criminal operation in which the bad actors are using fast clocks, that you see that the content is in this server in this country, 2 minutes later the same content is no longer there, but it's in this other server in this other country, 2 minutes later the content hops to a different server in another country, 2 minutes later the content hops to the next server in a fourth or fifth country and so on. So how does law enforcement address that? It's hard. Very hard. Double fast locks right there. It's a technique that was seen in a huge cloud, how would we put it? Criminal cloud service. It was called Avalanche. And within Avalanche, the bad actors were using double fast locks. And what that meant was that they were changing the name servers very often. So you would, if I wanted to query carlos.whatever, right now I would query ns1.carlos.whatever. If I query it within 2 minutes, I would query ns1.kathy.next. Within the next 2 minutes, I would query ns3.camera.yuhu. And every 2 or 3 minutes, the name servers would be changing. And then the name servers were on top of that, changing the IP addresses every 2 or 3 minutes, or the short TTL that the criminals had defined. So that was twice as bad and twice as annoying and twice as complicated. But the good investigators were able to find that out and address it, and the bad guys are behind bars. And the head is behind bars. I mentioned the DNS as a covert exfiltration channel. And the malware types, actually, and it's not only for data exfiltration, but also to, and mainly, for actual control of the malware that's infected or compromised the devices. So through the DNS, the criminals provide instructions to the devices. The criminals modify the malware that's compromised the devices. The criminals can inject more malware through the DNS. So it's a headache. Because as I said, the port 53, which is used for DNS communications, cannot be blocked. So it's up to the network administrator to have good techniques in place to be able to detect these things. And there are some techniques that can be used that I can't refer to right now because that would be another 3 hours. It's up to them. It's up to each network administrator to implement those techniques. We just saw these two examples of malware types that are doing this among the many, many more that do. It's Feederbot and Morto. You see here the botnet command and control encodes instructions in DNS text responses. So the compromised device sends a query to the name server, and the bad guy has configured that DNS server to provide a response in the form that the query was for a text record, and that text record is instructions to the compromised device, basically. And those instructions can be anything. Those instructions can be attack these targets and traffic this way, so it can be anything. The evolving DNS threat landscape. DDoS as a service. Talk about Mirai. Does any of you remember Mirai? Yeah. That was a bad situation there. Mirai was... How should we put it again? There was association between providers of what are known as booter services or stressor services with this attack, with this botnet. What's a booter service or a stressor service? It's a website that some kid sets up somewhere where what they claim is that they sell the capability for you to test how resilient and how stable your servers are. So you pay a certain amount of money, and what they claim that they provide is, we will send this amount of traffic during this period of time so that you can test your infrastructure to see if it's resilient and to see if it will stand an attack. The thing is that those booter or stressor services sell that service to anyone, whether or not they operate the infrastructure that is to be tested. In other words, these are DDoS for hire services, and it's not hard to find them. You can go online, make a very easy lookup using your favorite search engine, and just find them. And you can. There are some that are dumb enough that accept credit card payments, which makes things easier for the light side of the force. All you need to do is pay, and then provide the information on the target that you want to test, because of course you want to make sure that it's a resilient network, and knock them offline. That's not cool. And they do that via different means, one of which is the operation of botnets. Of course, we already talked about fast flux and double fast flux. There's a mention of Avalanche. We'll talk about it like a couple slides ahead. Avalanche is a very cool case, and you'll see why. The Internet of Things. I didn't want to mention the V word that's in between Internet of and Things, but that V word is unfortunately so true, and everyone knows that it's nothing new. A good example of how things can go bad, think of the attack. I think it was against Brian Krebs. Was it October 2016, maybe? September? And against OVH, which, by the way, OVH is an ICANN-accredited registrar. They're also a large hosting provider in France. They were able to detect that the attack was coming from something around 146,000 video cameras, digital video cameras. The botnet had the capacity to send 1.5 terabytes of data, which is, back then it was simply unseen. That's insane. That amount of data, I can't picture it in my head. But they got to measure 1.1 terabytes in actual traffic directed against them. And it was video cameras. Again, this is nothing new, but it's just something worthy of mention, I guess. The DNS was one of the vectors used in that attack, not the only vector, but it was a vector that was certainly used. And then we have WannaCry, which is also mentioned ahead, so I'm going to skip it for now. Avalanche. Avalanche was a cloud criminal service. Imagine you went to a website, created an account, logged in, and you could choose the malware type, the kind of campaign that you wanted to run. And what these guys did was that they would run everything for you. All you needed to do was pay them, and they would run everything for you. They would provide the malware for you to infect your customers, that they would actually infect them for you. They would register the domain names for command and control on your behalf. They would register those domain names for you. They would provide the hosting for the malware distribution sites. They would operate all that for you. So that was like the next level in sophistication with regards to provision of criminal services. Avalanche was, of course, heavy in DGA registration. in domains generated automatically by an algorithm. So when the law enforcement action took place, a process within ICANN, that process is called the Expedited Registry Security Request, was followed, and through that process, 832,000 domain names were taken away from the hands of the criminals. So from one instant to the next, thanks to all the cooperation from the law enforcement partners and some folks in the private sector, the criminals completely lost control of their infrastructure. Like, it's gone. It's still there, but they can't touch it. They can't control it anymore. It feels nice when that happens. These are some of the strings that were to be created by Avalanche, by the botnet, for its command and control purposes. And all those 830,000 domain names were to be created under a bunch of TLDs. Both CCTLDs and GTLDs. As I said, criminals will abuse whoever they can. They don't care, of course. Well, there's one thing. Some criminals in a certain part of the world will craft their malware in a way that it will not attack IP addresses within their own jurisdiction, because they don't want their own law enforcement to go after them, because it can be really bad for them. So they just skip completely their own IP address space, so that the thing, of course, then is that they can't leave their country, which is really not a bad thing. So they make prisoners of themselves within their own borders. So it's good that they stay there, but it's bad because they do a lot of harm. This is the outcome of the Avalanche takedown. We have, and thanks to content that is provided by Europol and the FBI, that entire presentation is only to talk about this case. This is just the outcome. 5 arrests in 4 countries, 37 searches in 7 countries, 39 servers seized in 13 countries, 221 servers taken offline, 64 TLDs, 832,000 domains in 26 countries, and a lot of victim remediation and awareness raising and prevention. So this is like a really huge scale operation. And it was a good thing. It was a hit, a big, big, big hit. Then WannaCry. WannaCry was a weird thing. If you look at it from the perspective of the DNS, it was interesting in that, unlike what's usually seen in terms of malware types usually using domain names for command and control within any normal TLD, GTLDs or CCTLDs, command and control for WannaCry was mostly provided by, I think it was 7 .onion domains. If you remember .onion was defined by the ITF as a special use TLD, which means it will never be in the root, which means ICANN will never have anything to do with .onion. So there was no way to take down the command and control infrastructure associated with WannaCry. However, this young researcher, Marcus Hutchins, the British kid, he was analyzing the code. He had managed to obtain a sample of WannaCry, and he was analyzing it and came across a string that was within the code, I believe. It was hard-coded in the malware. He checked for it. It wasn't registered. He registered it, and he stopped the spread of the malware. By pure chance, he had no idea that was going to happen. But just by registering that domain name, he stopped the spread of the malware. The reasoning is basically what's up here. If my ransomware does connect to the command and control, then exit process to avoid analysis. Fortunately, that was there. And the spread of WannaCry stopped. Then the criminals behind WannaCry attempted registering a second string, but it was also very quickly registered, and in the end, the spread was stopped, fully stopped, and they just moved elsewhere. DNS abuse is a contentious topic within ICANN. There are different views. There are some who, on the security side, on the law enforcement side, have concerns with regards to WHOIS accuracy. Of course, the impact that the GDPR is going to have on operations and how WHOIS is going to look after May 25th when the GDPR enters into force. There's concerns with regards to things like time for response, the time to react whenever a report of abuse is submitted. There are different types of concerns in this regard. Then on the other side, which is a side that we as an organization also have to listen to, is the concern that ICANN should not exceed its remit or step out of its scope, in the sense that if it's content, then ICANN should not have anything to do with it. And what that translates to is the ICANN contracts not including provisions that would allow for the takedown of, for example, pirated content. That discussion is to be held by the community, not by the organization. So those are discussions that have to be held by you guys, basically. We facilitate those discussions, but we can't participate in them. Importantly, the Public Safety Working Group. The Public Safety Working Group is the home where law enforcement, both civil and criminal, resides within the ICANN structure, the larger set or sets of ICANN committees, etc. Before the PSWG, as it is known, before it existed, the law enforcement community hadn't really found a home until, I believe it was in Beijing, when Lorraine Capin from the U.S. Federal Trade Commission asked Fadi Shehadi, the former CEO, whether he would be willing to consider having law enforcement a formal place within the ICANN structure. And he threw the ball back at the law enforcement community, bring me a proposal. And so they did. And that proposal is what we know today as the PSWG, which is a working group or a subgroup within the larger governmental advisory committee. That's where they reside. The purpose of the PSWG is to provide advice to the GAC, the Governmental Advisory Committee, and to the larger ICANN community, of course. Some topics that they focus on is DNS abuse, of course, ways in which domain names are used for malicious purposes, to harm users, the GDPR, as it's going to have, like it or not, it's going to have an implication on the WHOIS information that's available for threat research and investigations, carrier-grade translation, CGNNet. That's, in short terms, that's a technique that some ISPs use. These and other similar techniques are used by some ISPs when they prefer not to migrate to IPv6, basically. So they, instead of having to move up to IPv6, they create huge local area networks and assign their customers internal IP addresses. So there are IP addresses that are only be meant to be in the public internet that we would see out if we were analyzing traffic, and there are IP addresses that are only meant to exist within private networks. Those IP addresses should never be seen out on the public internet. What they do, and that's the case, for example, in your company, in your home, your devices are assigned those private IP addresses. What these ISPs do is that they assign those private IP addresses to their customers, even if it's 500, 1,000, 10,000, and they create neighborhood-wide private networks, local area networks, with one single public IP address. And that creates a complication for law enforcement, because when law enforcement knocks on the door serving, for example, legal paperwork, or when they send a subpoena to the ISP asking for the information regarding the user that sent traffic, this traffic from this IP address this day at this hour, then the ISP will respond, well, I don't know. That's 10,000 users behind that public IP address. And in many countries, there are no obligations, or they may be, but they are not enforced with regards to the retention obligations, maintenance and storing of logs, traffic logs and logins and logouts. So in many places, you log in, you log out, and poof, the data is gone. No one knows that you were there. The ISP doesn't know you were there. So it's complicated. That's one of the things that the PSWG has discussed in the past. Fast logs, of course. It's a technique that criminals use. These are two simple examples. It's by no means a taxative or restrictive list of contractual provisions within the ICANN bigger web of contracts that have to do with anti-abuse. There are many. We could have an hours-long conversation only to talk about anti-abuse from a contractual perspective within ICANN. I can mention that the registries do have the obligation to monitor their zones for security threats. That means that they have the obligation to look into the domains that exist within them. If I was the .carlos TLD, I would have to look at all the .carlos domain names and determine which of those are phishing, spam, malware, command control, and report those statistics and metrics to ICANN. That's the obligation on the side of the registries. Also, if I'm not wrong, I believe the registries also have to provide their abuse point of contact information. But I think that's as far as it goes, specifically with regards to anti-abuse for the registries. On the side of the registrars, however, it's a little more specific. And these more specific provisions are there in that agreement. That agreement is called the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, or RAA, as we know it informally. Those more specific provisions are there as a result of the 12 law enforcement recommendations that were presented by what now is the PSWG. You know, back then, it was just law enforcement community through the GAC in the Costa Rica meeting of 2012. I think that's when they presented those 12 recommendations. That triggered the board to order the staff to start negotiations with the registrar stakeholder group. Those negotiations took place during some months, and the outcome is the 2013 RAA that includes a little more specific provisions on anti-abuse. Some on the operational security community still would like to see more clear and more stringent provisions, but at that point, law enforcement was okay with the text that was agreed by both the registrar stakeholder group and the ICANN organization. Some of those obligations, to talk about them quickly, include, for example, that registrars have to take reasonable action when they receive reports of abuse. Of course, if you ask 10 lawyers what reasonable means, you'll have 20 different answers. Which makes it complicated, but that's what's there in the RAA. Another obligation that they have is that they have to provide their abuse point of contact as well. That information has to be, I believe, either published on the website and or on the WHOIS data. It's usually in the WHOIS data. I believe they also have to put it, publish it on their websites. Yeah, I'm unsure, as you can tell. I think it has to be there, but I'm not sure. There's an interesting provision there that's specific to law enforcement. When a law enforcement agency from a registrar's same jurisdiction sends a report of abuse to that registrar, but remember it has to be within the same jurisdiction. The registrar has to provide a human response within 24 hours. That response, as I said, has to be human, not automated. The response then doesn't have to be, we suspended the domain. The response can simply be, ACK, we acknowledge receipt. That can be, that's a valid response. And the response, and the person who provides that response according to the text of the agreement has to be someone who can basically decide what's going to happen with the report of abuse, whether or not the domain should be suspended or not. There are some jurisdictions in which this provision helps a lot, where there are many registrars operating from, but there are some jurisdictions in which there are very few or none at all. So the efficacy or the effects of this provision vary per jurisdiction, of course. Then privacy and proxy providers, if you remember those services that are used by registrants to have someone in their stead, someone else's information on the host output of their domain names instead of their own. If I have a website and I don't want my name to be out there or my address or my email address, then those privacy and proxy providers that are controlled by registrars, they also have to provide their own abuse point of contact information. I think that's it. Those are the topics that we wanted to cover. It's a lot, as I said, DNS abuse. While it seems straightforward in that when you see a domain name that's used for command and control of a botnet, then it's clear that it is. When you see it, you can do all the technical analysis, and there's no way to disprove what the actual technical scientific evidence shows, because it's what's there. But then there are cases in which it's a little more complicated. So it's a topic that's up for continued discussion. It's up for the community to continue growing and expanding on these topics. And our job, I failed to say that at the beginning, I am a director of Security, Stability, and Resiliency Engagement with the Security, Stability, and Resiliency team. We sit under the office of the CTO. We do a lot of engagement with the operational security community and law enforcement, and we seek many things. We try to bring them closer to the ICANN world. We are very interested in having them understand all the discussions that take place here. Just a few weeks ago, a representative from the domain name industry attended a security conference on our invitation. That's the Messaging Malware and Mobile Anti-Abuse Working Group. That was Jonathan Frakes as executive director of the Domain Name Association. He had positive interactions. That's one of the things that we do. We engage, we try to bring people who may have traditionally seen each other as in opposed benches, we try to bring them together to an understanding, at least so that they can understand where each one is coming from, so that something can be built up on that understanding. We train law enforcement. One of ICANN's duties, as you may remember, is to help maintain the security, stability, and resiliency of the domain name system. And that means that law enforcement has to understand what it means when they are looking at a botnet investigation or when they are looking at a malware distribution investigation, and they need to understand how the DNS works. So we help them understand that from that perspective so that they can help keep the SSR of the system, as we call it, with yet another acronym. So I think that's it. If anyone has questions, please feel free.
As a reminder, please give your name and your affiliation if you have one. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Marcy Sharma from India. One suggestion is, like, it's a question also, whether ICANN has prepared some baseline security standards for DNS implementations or operations. Could it be maintained? Otherwise, it could be operational device only, and if there is no security, all kind of abuses will happen. And then there will be only post-analysis. So could some minimum baseline security standards could be put in place before coming any operational DNS into the...
I would suggest that you look for documents published by DNS.org, which is the community of DNS operators. Of course, needless to say, standards, ITF standards that may have some security component with regards to the DNS. And then MOG. Look for MOG. The acronym is M3AAWG. They recently, about a year and a half ago, they updated what is known. I forgot the name. If you look MOG DNS threats, you'll find it, I'm sure. It also provides some good information. So that those are the communities or the groups that I think have worked and delivered on documents or standards, as you were mentioning.
It's just a guideline. Can we just enforce it that before coming online these devices, these minimum security standards should be implemented?
Cannot be enforced. Anyone can set up and run and operate a DNS server anywhere in the world. There's no way to enforce it. It's something that's technically impossible to prevent. There's no rule, there's no binding. Anyone can do it however they want. It's voluntary, which doesn't make it easy. Now, with regards to what you were saying, speaking of the voluntary component of it, there are standards and means of doing things that have been defined by the technical community for years, since 1997, for example, the filtering of the forged IP addresses. If you look at BCP 38 or BCP 84, you'll see that those best current practices date 20 years or more. Yet, because it's voluntary, they have not been widely implemented, or not as widely as you would have expected. It's voluntary. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Actually,
what was your name and affiliation, please?
My name is Haru Al-Hassan from Nigeria. Our challenges in the developing countries is how do we train our law enforcement agencies to meet up to this challenge of criminals? Because you have demonstrated a lot of ways in which DNS can be poisoned, can be attacked in several ways. Then how do we train our law enforcement to meet up to this challenge of the criminals?
I think a proper route would be to reach out to the ICANN engagement staff in Africa. That'd be Pierre. I don't know if you've met him already. And share your concern with him. Then what would happen next is that Pierre, with our team, with the SSR team, we would coordinate and have law enforcement agencies participate in a DNS abuse training. So my suggestion is reach out to Pierre, because that's a very valid concern. Yes, sir.
Brent Carey from .nz. I'm wondering if you've got any links into internet and jurisdiction. Last week I came from Ottawa and there was a domain name Stream, and obviously infrastructure abuse, registration abuse and content abuse are all merging, and I was just hoping that you've got some links back there too.
I don't have them. Go figure. I don't have them. But yeah. Yeah, I know that Bertrand organized that forum in Ottawa. Some of my colleagues with ICANN were there.
Because there was a very noticeable absence from the law enforcement area.
Okay. I didn't know. Maybe that's a conversation to have with the PSWG. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's one more.
Yeah. That's the next tweet. One side, we do not have a robust mechanism for definitely update this GDPR. For who is? And the second, the another way, we don't have control over these security issues. It is going to be a difficult path ahead, it looks like.
What's going to be difficult?
I mean, one side, we do not have the authentic who is. Mm-hmm. And after this GDPR, maybe we won't be able to see who is coming to us,
okay,
and where we
okay.
are going. And
secondly, we do not have
security of the DNS. We are not controlling it. So there is no control and no authenticity of the person where we are going.
Let's wait. My suggestion is for you to participate in those discussions, provide feedback through the calls from the ICANN organization. It's usually the CEO who's been lately calling for people to provide feedback. So do participate, because that's the way in which you can have your voice heard. And it is actually heard. It's not a rhetorical thing to say. It is heard. So throw your concerns in there. That's the right place. These are some sessions. These are not the only sessions that are relevant to DNS abuse, so just keep this in mind. If you can go back in time, you'll be able to go yesterday at 11:30 to the PSWG update. Then tomorrow, 8:30 a.m., GAC PSWG meeting. I would recommend you attend those two in the morning. I have a slight preference for the GDPR just because we're at this juncture of things, but both meetings are going to be interesting. Then it'll be interesting to see what the domain name industry is doing with their Healthy Domains Initiative. It's good to go see what they're doing, because they are doing interesting things as well. And then DAR. DAR is a tool that my team developed. It provides information on bad registrations and how they are aggregating more on one part rather than another part. So that's going to be interesting as well. I'm not going to say much about that, because I want you guys to go and attend that session. So just go, get in there, and have fun. Okay, well, thank you all so much for being here.
Just a reminder, the presentation slides are already in this session in the public schedule. We're going to add the transcripts as well as the recording for this session also in the public schedule within the next few days, so you could go back and see everything again. Thank you very much, and we're going to have our next How It Works session on internet networking at 3:30, not 3:15, but 3:30. Apologies, as we're going to be running a little bit late for that next How It Works. And the session on internet networking will be talking a lot about IPv4 and IPv6 protocols. So hope you could hang around, grab some coffee, and come back. Thank you.